Vic and I like to watch shows like 48 Hours and Dateline. You guys ever watch them? Okay, I want to make sure we weren't the only ones. And we like to watch them, but as Vic will tell you, every time it comes on, I'm like, oh, I bet this will be about somebody getting killed. Because every one of their shows is about somebody that got murdered. And what's interesting is that in most cases, when they interview the murderer's family members, they all say, well, you know, there's just no way that they could have ever committed that murder because they are just a nice, loving, and giving person. Just about two weeks ago, maybe you guys saw it in the news, there was a 20-year-old man from over in Cincinnati area that was arrested for planning to bomb the U.S. Capitol building. You guys heard that one? He was going to shoot any survivors that was around the building as they fled out. He had shown his support for ISIS. He had put some comments on some of the social media websites about he desired to be involved in the jihad movement. He had just bought 2 assault rifles and 600 rounds of ammunition moments before he was arrested. His father said that his son was innocent, that he would never do anything like that. His father said he is just a normal kid that loves to play video games. His best friend is a family cat. The high school that he graduated from, they talked to some of the teachers and the staff there, and they described him as having been an average student that showed no signs of trouble. He was quiet and an introvert. For years now, we have all heard the stories of Catholic priests that was guilty of molesting kids. We've all heard numerous stories of pastors that had fallen and stolen money from their churches or fallen into some form of sexual immorality. If you guys remember this, back in 2006, there was a male prostitute who went public and he had thrown some accusations that he had been having a 3-year affair with a pastor by the name of Ted Haggard. He also claimed that Ted Haggard had purchased crystal meth from him. Ted Haggard was the leader of the National Association of Evangelicals, which has about 45,000 churches in this nation that are in the membership. He pastored a church in Colorado Springs of 14,000 people. He had been known for standing up against the homosexual movement to legalize homosexual marriages. When the accusations went public, James Dobson, if you know him from Focus on the Family, defended Ted Haggard. He said, he is a good friend of mine, and there is no truth to these accusations. Ted Haggard adamantly denied the accusations that was being thrown out there about him, only to eventually confess that they were true. This past week, as I said, I was at a leadership conference out in Springfield, Illinois. There were over 1,000 pastors at this thing. At that conference, they said 33% of pastors confess to having some form of an inappropriate relationship with someone within their church. If that is accurate, then over 300 of the pastors at that conference was having some form of an inappropriate relationship with someone within their church. Another poll shows that about 50% of the people within churches have viewed pornography within the previous 30 days. How is it that people we consider good people can fall into such shocking and scandalous acts? How is it that Christians that claim to be followers of Christ can take part in such immoral and corrupt behavior? The answer is found in James chapter 1. And so let's turn to James chapter 1, and when you get there, say, Jesus, keep me from yielding to my temptations. James chapter 1. James, if you remember, from the last couple weeks, started out by talking about trials and how God brings trials into our lives in order to make us more like His Son. But about halfway into the chapter, he switches gears on us because now he starts talking about temptation. So let's look at verses 13 through 15 of James chapter 1. Verse 13, When tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does He tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. The first thing I want to point out here is, what does it mean to be tempted? To be tempted simply means to have one's thoughts, their beliefs, their standards, their morals tested. Temptations within themselves, they're not good, they're not bad. Because we can be tempted to do good things and we can be tempted to do bad things. But here in our verses, the context sets the stage because James is talking about temptations that we will face that will try to get us to violate our beliefs, violate our morals, violate our faith. And we're going to look more at that in a moment. The second thing I want to point out here is that anyone and everyone has temptations. Anybody here never been tempted? Betty raised her hand. Oh, I'm sorry, she's rubbing her nose. Verse 13 says, when tempted. Some translations say when he is tempted. There is no if in there, but when. In other words, temptation is going to happen. A person can live alone in the most secluded place in the world and still experience temptations. There's only two things that trials and temptations have in common. What are they? They're going to happen. They're unavoidable. What's the other one? Temptations are? Trials are. Now, the other one is they both start with a T. Okay. Andy's over being analytical on us. That's good, though, Andy. They're unavoidable, and they both start with a T. Then James goes on in verse 1 to say, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does He tempt anyone. The reason that he says God cannot be tempted is because God is invincible to any temptations to do evil. God and evil are mutually exclusive of each other. God and evil exist in completely two different and distinct realms that might have contact with each other, but yet are not affected by the other one. Illustration I found that really made sense to me is, I don't want you giving me credit for this one, I didn't come up with this one. God is like a sunbeam that shines down on a garbage dump. They have contact with each other, but the sunbeam is not affected by the garbage. James also says there that God does not tempt us. In other words, our temptations do not come from God. Now, when I read that, I asked myself, I'm like, why did James feel the need to tell us that God is not the one tempting us? What's the purpose? And I thought about that. And as I thought about that, I thought back over the years of working with people, and I come up with at least one reason. But let me say, this is my own opinion. Some people, when they are being tempted to do something sinful, they will say something like, but God wants me to be happy. Folks, that's the same as saying that God put this situation before you because He wants you to have it, therefore it can't be sinful. Another one I've heard over the years, and you've probably heard this too, is, Well, everything happens for a reason. Everything happens for a reason. As if God is the one behind everything, when the fact of the matter is, sometimes the reason something bad happens is because somebody made a wrong or a stupid decision. So don't be blaming God and saying everything happens for a reason. If you remember Adam, he caved into the temptation. What did he do? Who did he blame? God for giving him Eve. Yeah, he covered all bases. Let's get God in this one. Let's take out the wife. Folks, God has no more to do with our temptations than Satan has to do with our salvation. God might lead us into an area where temptations are possible, as he did with his son when the Holy Spirit led him into the wilderness to be tempted. God had before led me into a bar to witness to someone. Having loving to drink before Christ, that could have put me in an area of temptation. So sometimes God will lead us into an area, but he doesn't throw the temptation at us. God was not the source of his son's temptation. And that leads me to a question. If you remember the last 2 weeks, we talked about trials and how trials come from God and are for our good. And so let me ask you, if God is the one behind our trials that are designed to produce good in us, then who is the one behind temptations for getting us to do evil? Anybody? Satan. Is that what you're saying? Anybody agree with Mary? All right. Verse 14. But each one is tempted when by what? Huh? By his own evil desire. Now I find it interesting here that this is some of the best verses in all of Scripture dealing with temptation, and Satan's not even mentioned. Another area of Scripture that goes into great detail about our desire to sin is in the book of Romans. And Paul doesn't mention Satan either. Folks, our temptations are rooted inside of each one of us. All of us are born with what is referred to as a sin nature. Meaning that within our nature, we want to sin. Psalms 51:5 says that we are all born with a sin nature. Jesus said in Matthew 15:19, he says, for out of the heart, not out of Satan, out of the heart come evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality, theft, false witness, and slander. I read an article yesterday in a magazine, and it was titled, Why Do So Many Pastors Fall Into Sexual Immorality? The magazine is called Charisma. You guys heard of Charisma magazine? They're in all the Christian bookstores. They are targeted for charismatics and Pentecostals. And I encourage you, if you read them, do so with great caution. The article placed all the blame for pastors falling into sexual immorality on Satan. The problem with that is not what the Bible teaches. Folks, if God was to completely remove Satan from this world, lock him up in some closet somewhere, you would still be tempted to sin. That is why I kind of roll my eyes sometimes when I hear Christians going around binding Satan and casting him out and rebuking Satan. Because none of that is going to stop us from being tempted. Satan might be a problem, but he's not the problem. So I'm not trying to throw him out, but he is not our problem. The Bible teaches that we have three enemies that seek to destroy us in our lives. The first one, which we just saw, is our own flesh. It's our internal evil desires. And the second one is Satan, and thirdly, the world, the things that surround us, our culture. They all three of those play a role in tempting us to do wrong things. Satan and the world around us certainly have the ability to tempt us. And they do a very good job. But the root cause of our desire to sin is in here. Now, as I said earlier, a person can go live alone in the most secluded place on the face of the earth, and they will still experience temptations. You can remove Satan from the world, and you will still face temptations. As a matter of fact, if we will learn to control our fleshly desires, the world and Satan won't stand a chance against tempting us anyway. Now, let's look at the process here of how temptations come about and how temptations lead us to sin. Verses 14 and 15. Each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. The first thing I want to point out here is that temptations in and of themselves, as I said earlier, they're not sinful. There's nothing sinful about temptation. They don't become sin until halfway through verse 15. Each one is tempted when by his own evil desire he is dragged away and enticed. James uses a couple metaphors here that relate to trapping and fishing to explain how we fall into the traps of temptations. The phrase dragged away, or some of your other translations will say drawn away or lured, is used as a hunting term that refers to baiting a trap so as to lure in unsuspecting animals into the trap. The term enticed is a fishing term that refers to using bait to draw a fish out of their place of safety so as to get them to bite the hook. Here's the picture. People that trap, people that fish, will use a type of bait that is attractive to whatever it is they're trying to catch. They will use a type of bait that looks like the real thing. They will move their bait like the real thing. It will smell like the real thing. It will taste like the real thing. They will use a type of bait that looks something like the fish or the animal thinks in their head that they need, or something that they think they want. They will use whatever type of bait that will look harmless or beneficial to whatever it is they're trying to catch. They will use a type of bait that will appeal to the senses of whatever it is they're trying to catch. The whole purpose of bait is to get the desire of the targeted animal to become so intense that it causes them to lose their sense of caution and discernment, which will then get them to take the bait, causing them to be caught. In the same way, temptations are designed to look appealing to our evil desires to such a degree that we will lose our sense of caution and discernment, which will then in turn cause us to bite into the temptation, causing us to get caught in that net of sin. Folks, Satan knows we have a sin nature that desires to sin, just like a fish has an appetite that desires to eat. Therefore, he uses our evil desires to draw us away from what we know to be truthful and moral, and he just kind of dangles things in front of us that are attractive. Much like a fisherman dangles a lure in front of a fish, and once they fall for the attraction, they're hooked. Verse 15. Then, after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Here James changes the metaphor from trapping and fishing to an illustration of the process of childbirth to explain how our temptations go from just being a desire to becoming sin. Let me paraphrase for you what James is saying here. Then, after our temptations have found a home in our heart, it will bring forth sin, and once our sin reaches maturity, it will take over and can result in death. Let me give you three quick lessons from these verses. Number one, sin is attractive. How do I know that? Because if sin was not attractive, we wouldn't be tempted by it. Secondly, sin is addictive. If it wasn't, it would never get to that full-grown death stage we see in verse 15. Thirdly, sin does not just happen. It is instead a result of a process of things happening. If you ever watch shows like 48 Hours and Dateline, you know that anytime someone is murdered, the police automatically look at the spouse first, and then close friends or relatives. And so let's take a hypothetical story. Let's think this through from beginning to end to see how a moral and upstanding person can go from loving their spouse with all their heart to murdering them. A man and a woman were raised in church. They lived a moral and an upstanding life as they grew up. They got married to the love of their life. They got involved in church and were serving. They love spending time together. They have some children. They're both great parents of their kids. They go on family vacations. They're living a leave-it-to-beaver kind of life. But when the husband goes to work every day, one of his co-workers has one of them girly calendars up, and he just happens to see it every day as he walks by. His internal evil desire that has been dormant for years is all of a sudden being enticed. On his ride back and forth to work, he listens to some music on the radio that glorifies immorality. His internal desire that was awakened by the calendar at work is now becoming more awakened by being entertained by it. Then at home, while he's watching TV and these beer commercials pop up and it's showing women in bikinis standing around a swimming pool. At work, he hears guys talking about how much fun they had with some girl they met this weekend. The bait of immorality just keeps dangling out there in front of him. And his sin nature that was once in hibernation is now wide awake and wanting to be fed. That is verse 14. Now let's bring verse 15 into our story. The bait of immorality has become so attractive that it has lured this man away from his morals. He has reached the point where he has lost his sense of caution and discernment. And so now he is ready to begin to feed his evil desires, and so he begins to view pornography on the internet. And his sin nature feeds on pornography, and they, coming together, give birth to sin. The man bit into the bait of temptation. Now he's caught up in a net of sin. From there, he begins to contemplate taking his sin to the next level by having an affair. After a while, he fears getting caught. Or he begins to think that his wife might get in the way of his so-called fun. And so he desires he has to do what he has to do to get her out of the way. That is every 48 hours and every Dateline show you can watch. What started out looking like a Leave It to Beaver show ended up on a 48-hour show where his friends will be interviewed and say, well, there's no way he could have ever murdered his wife because they live that Leave It to Beaver kind of life. What makes all this so sad is that the man never had the intention of doing what he'd done. Never. But he failed to reject the temptations that were being dangled in front of him. Folks, I can tell you this, a fish has no desire to end up in a frying pan. But once they bite into the temptation being dangled in front of them, they can put up a fight all they want, but they are going to end up in a frying pan. I can assure you that King David never in his wildest dreams ever thought he'd be guilty of murder. but it was the end result of a chain of events that he should have never partook in to begin with. Folks, that same kind of story is true when it comes to other things as well. It's true when you find somebody that was a good person of integrity falls into embezzling money. It's true when you find somebody that robs a bank. It's true when you deal with an alcoholic. No one ever just embezzles money. No one ever just robs a bank. No one ever just becomes an alcoholic. No one ever just becomes a homosexual. It is always a process. Listen. People don't have a problem with pornography. They don't have a problem with alcohol. They don't have a problem with stealing, anger, whatever it is. That's not their problem. The problem is they have failed to starve their evil desires and chose to feed them. Instead, they have chosen to feed their sin nature to the point that their evil desires have become so overweight that they become morally and spiritually unhealthy. And sometimes it will get so out of control that it will cost them their lives. And so the question is, how should we respond to temptations so that they don't turn into sin in our own lives? First and foremost, pay attention to your conscience. Pay attention to your conscience. If you begin to feel a sense of guilt, you better shut things down. Get away from whatever or whoever it is that's tempting you. 1 Corinthians 6:18 says, flee from sexual immorality. 2 Timothy 2:22, flee youthful passions. 1 Corinthians 10:14, flee from idolatry. Folks, that word flee means to run away. It means to vanish. It means to escape. God never tells you to walk away from your temptations. Flee. Just get away. Folks, the first 9 chapters of the book of Proverbs tells us to stay away from people that are trying to get us to do things that we know are wrong. First 9 chapters of Proverbs teaches us to avoid going to certain areas and certain places that have the potential to entice us. Simply put, avoid places, avoid media outlets, avoid people, avoid situations, whatever it is that will ignite or feed your evil desires. Let me put this as plain as I can. If you are on a diet, don't go to a donut shop or an ice cream shop. That's as simple as it gets. Secondly, pursue something else. First of all, pay attention to your conscience. Flee and pursue something else. 1 Corinthians 6:11. Flee these things, but pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, and gentleness. 2 Timothy 2:22, flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with all who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Philippians 4:8 tells us to fill our minds with things that are true, honorable, just, pure, lovely, commendable, excellent, and worthy of praise. James 4:7, submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil. Doesn't say bind him, cast him out, whatever you want to do, drop kick him. It says resist the devil and he will flee from you. Colossians 3:2, set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. And I'm going to throw this one out there for married couples, because it is extremely useful in preventing some of the immoral temptations that come within marriage. Anytime I've done a marriage workshop, I throw this in there because it's crucial. 1 Corinthians 7:5. This is talking to a husband and a wife. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer, but then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Let me be very candid, but yet very discreet here. A marriage that lacks regular times of intimacy is a marriage that is inviting Satan in to tempt the husband and the wife to find pleasure by other means. Not my opinion, right here. Let me close now. I don't know where you guys stand, all of you. You know, some of you may not be walking with the Lord. God has never tempted you to sin. But here's what He does do. He offers you deliverance from the penalty and the power of sin. It begins when you come clean before the Lord. Just be open, be honest about your sin before the Lord. Ask Him to come into your heart, forgive you, and begin to lead you away from the life of sin. And when you're willing to do that, He's ready to do His part. On the other side of that, if you're here today, you're already a believer. You realize that you have yielded to some temptations and that you have gone on to entertain those temptations and you want to begin to have victory. The altar's open. As you know, we're going to be doing communion in a few minutes, and most of you that are familiar with communion knows that it is dangerous to take communion with sin in your life. A few years ago, I was a guest speaker at another church, and I got up and I talked about the subject of sexual immorality, because some of you know my past in it. And afterwards, one of the deacons came up and acknowledged how he had been trying to pick up a prostitute. Another time, I had a woman come up after the service, after her husband and children had already went out and got in the van, to tell me that the week before she had drove over an hour to meet a guy in a town that she had met in a medical facility she'd been in about a month earlier. Folks, here is what I know to be true. Where there is a group of Christians, there are some Christians facing some serious temptations and or that are entertaining those serious temptations. I know that to be a fact. I face them. You face them. Something else I know to be true is we are never called to be Lone Ranger Christians. You need to have a Tonto with you. You need to find some other believer that you believe in, that you trust. You need to be open and honest with them. It needs to be someone you know is not going to spread your news. It's not going to be somebody that looks down on you because you've fallen. It needs to be somebody you know is going to love you and pick you up and then hold you accountable. I'm going to repeat what I just said. Here's what I know to be true. In any group of Christians, there are people being tempted and or entertaining those temptations. And I can tell you this, the longer you put off dealing with it, the more hooked you will become. You can't avoid it. It's like the fish when you hook him. He fights, tries to get off. Fishermen's reeling him in. Out of the fish's hands. He went up in a boat and in a frying pan. I want to encourage you, if that pertains to any of you, face the music today. Because it will not get any better. I have never seen anyone that chose to follow a way of sin that come out better at the other end. And I specifically think as we get ready to take communion, it's absolutely crucial today, because if you do have sin in your life, if you are entertaining temptations, come clean before that, or just don't take part in it, but you still need to come clean, because it's only going to get worse. So folks, as we play this final song, the altar is open. If you need to come forward and seek the Lord, I'll be up here. You can talk to me. Maybe it's somebody sitting next to you or somebody else. Maybe, you know, if you're a female, you need to get another woman to come up with you, a man with a man, whatever. This is an area I don't play with, because I have literally watched godly people fall. And they always fall further than they ever thought they would fall. Always. Sin is a slippery slope. It's not a cliff you jump off of. You just slide downhill. You will hit bottom. So as we close, the altar's open. Well, guys, we're going to move into communion. Ralph's going to head this up this morning. I want to throw one more thing out there. And I know that, you know, if you got something going on, maybe the last thing you want to do is come up here, because everybody else is going to take notes. But I want to let you know, you can see me privately, or like I said, if you've got somebody else in here that you love and trust and believe in, get a hold of them, guys. Don't hang on it. Don't hang on it. Don't hang on those temptations, the entertainment of it. Wrong place to be. And I've been around enough of you guys to know that these people in here will love you and help you.